All right. Well, we'd like you to begin by just telling us what your pathway into substance abuse research has been. How did you get interested in the problem?
I went to college at Villanova from the 60 to 64, and interestingly, I couldn't decide what I wanted to do when I was going through college. I really loved history, liked political science, and liked psychology. And I decided that my senior year I was going to go to graduate school, but couldn't figure out really what I wanted to go into. I really loved political science, but my assumption was I couldn't get a job, and who gets a PhD in political science? So I decided, based upon how well I would actually do in the courses, my final semester of my senior, or my first semester of my senior year, I would go based upon just whatever I got the best grade in. So there wasn't a lot of rational discussion about how I ended up there, but I decided on psychology, but I was more interested in a broader context of just the brain and the brain function, and it really interested me a great deal, and decided to go into psychology from a pharmacologic perspective or a neurobiology perspective. At that time, and this is now the early 60s, there really wasn't a field of neurobiology. We called it physiological psychology or something to do with it. That clearly wasn't clinical. It wasn't experimental operant behavior. It was, you know, dealing with the biology of psychology. And that was a relatively new area about which we knew almost nothing. I mean, there was, in the early 60s, there was really no information at all.
Who had carved out any, was there anything?
Not very much. The 60s was, I ended up doing very well in the psychology course. I ended up going into psychology, but picked a program at Purdue University that was very biologically oriented and had interest in biological systems. Mm-hmm. The typical experiment back in those days was to, though, try to go into the brain and see if you could evoke certain behaviors. This was the era of brain stimulation. It was very new at the time, and there was even some basic self-administration models developing, although they weren't particularly sophisticated, but there were some attempts to manipulate brain function and then look at all kinds of behaviors. And in particular, I got very intrigued by a guy named Robert Meyer, who was at Purdue at the time. I think he subsequently went to North Carolina, but he was at Purdue. He had trained in England with a Nobel laureate whose name I'm blocking out at the moment, and was coming back to Purdue. He had done some work at Purdue, but had been at Colgate University. And I had worked with a very junior faculty member for the first couple of years, getting my coursework done and stuff like that. And he was interested in what I was doing, but that wasn't really providing a lot of guidance. I was his first graduate student, and it wasn't much guidance at all. I got through the coursework fine, but I was evolving an interest in really drug abuse, and the reasons for that are pretty common. There was a little bit of it in my family that was sort of an issue for me, but it really, the whole area just intrigued me, of people getting so obsessed with drugs, and that drugs became such a overpowering force that they would consume their lives, and they would just become addicted. But pretty much, and I was convinced at that time that this wasn't a character defect. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something wrong with personality. There were lots of theories circulating in the 60s that this was in some sense a personality disorder, or there was an addictive personality. Mm-hmm. There was just something about these people. But clearly it was a behavioral trait, and it had to do with bad habits, and it had to do with just not being a strong person and able to overcome things.
Let me ask you about your prior experiences with addiction. You said some family members.
Yeah.
What was the nature of your encounters with that?
One was my father, who was clearly an alcoholic. There was just no question about that. Although there was a lot of denial for years. But I remember also my grandfather, my mother's side, not my father's, was also really heavily into alcohol. Mm-hmm. Clearly he had a problem. I always attributed it to the fact that he had a hard life and whatever. But it became clear to me, looking at my father and looking at him, that there was a lot more to it than that. There seemed to be
an element of compulsion, and even realizing that it did bad things to you, they would nevertheless go ahead and not apparently be able to control it. It didn't seem to me that either of those individuals were bad people. I think they just slipped into things. And I'm sure my dad, I never knew him because he died when I was five, but he died of, quote, liver failure. Mm-hmm. And back in the 40s, I guess they really didn't know if it was liver cancer or whatever, but there seems to be some evidence, not talked about very much, that he also was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. the nutrition wasn't all that great. So there was certainly a history of it in the family. Mm-hmm. And it intrigued me that I thought it was more than just simply being a bad person and just not being able to control yourself.
Mm-hmm. And to whom would you attribute those addictive personality theories?
In the 60s?
Yeah.
It was a lot of just the popular, I can't really think of any individuals in particular, but like in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of at least folklore and a lot of what you saw in psychology courses that I took mm-hmm. in college attributed addiction to some sort of a personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And it was actually considered in courses that were titled abnormal psychology. Mm-hmm. And it would be included in that sort of thing, as along with other deviant behaviors such as schizophrenia and things that fell in this mm-hmm. in this whole general category. So the scientific community as a whole just didn't pay much attention to it and attributed it to just some basic character flaw. These people are in some way flawed. So Bob Meyer was coming in, and he had an immediate interest in this area. He wanted to expand his program considerably and wanted to know if I wanted to work with him, and I was happy to jump on him and work with him. And he was doing some things that were just intriguing with primates. in planting cannula, which at the time was revolutionary. It was an absolute revolutionary technique. Plus, he perfected a technique called the push-pull cannula. Mm-hmm. And what it was an outer cannula with also an inner one that protruded a little bit further than the outer one. And the concept was, with the smaller inner one, that you would infuse saline solution, or you could infuse something else, and then suck it up with the outer one, so that you were now perfusing the local area of the brain and take out the fluid and then analyze it. And his assumption was that you could begin to infer how the brain was working by measuring chemicals or substances in the fluid that came out from nerve cells. And that was, at the time, just really cutting edge and really, really very revolutionary. So I learned a lot about surgery and about the brain structure at the time, and just being able to get in there and manipulate the brain, because you could also infuse with this cannula, you could infuse drugs of interest, and then look at particular behaviors. So there was a lot of mapping being done, where people were saying, what happens when you stick an electrode or a cannula in a certain area? Can you influence behaviors in a certain way? And in particular, with the alcohol model that we were using. We were only using alcohol at the time. No, opiates wasn't really a very big drug at the time. It was really alcohol was a big concern for people. There was not much funding for it. But I at that time, he had a grant from the Office of Naval Research, which was very interested in the problem because of impact on armed forces. So I learned a great deal about the brain and the anatomy of the brain, and basically trying to see which areas of brain were involved in abnormal behaviors, including drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. So I did quite a bit of studies looking at preferences for alcohol among animals, but there was a level of analysis that just wasn't deep enough. It just didn't really get to the real core of the question. We were looking at correlations more than we were anything else, just region. This brain, if you stimulate this brain, the rat may or may not drink more alcohol or less alcohol. We didn't know what it meant, mm-hmm. but we're trying to hone in on areas. And in fact, that early research though, did establish the pathways for reward systems at home, because we were able to go in and stimulate an area or infuse a chemical, acetylcholine. At that time, we knew about three transmitters, I guess: norepinephrine, serotonin, and acetylcholine, and those were the ones we always tried in experiments because that was the prototypic thing, and we knew those to be transmitters. We didn't really know about all the other transmitters that were out. When I got my PhD, actually, then was I picked an actual experiment to do, or a series of experiments to do in rodents, and actually did it in rats with Bob Myers' strong encouragement. I was really interested in other factors that would affect alcohol drinking. Mm-hmm. And one notion came to me, Joe Brady's experiment at the time on the executive monkey. And this was a really novel approach. I'll tell you an interesting story about that in a second. But what it did was there were two animals, two rhesus monkeys pressing a bar for, I've forgotten what they were doing now. They had a choice of alcohol and water to drink. The executive monkey was the monkey who basically his lever worked. And what that monkey could do is forestall punishment by learning how to avoid this particular nasty pleasure. And in fact, he got some alcohol on the side. So all the decisions, and that's why it was called the executive monkey, all the decisions were made by this monkey. So he made the decision of whether or not they got shocked and whether or not he could drink. Alcohol was available to both animals. The other one was yoked to the executive, meaning that whatever the executive did happened to him. So he had no control, though. Mm-hmm. So his bar was inoperative, so he could press the bar as often as he wanted, but he had no control over his events and what was going to occur. Well, Joe found a big increase in ulcer formation in these animals, suggesting that, of course, the executive has all of this burden, and that they tended to drink more alcohol. So here was a link. There was, you know, the stress of being an executive leads to further consumption of alcohol. So my experiment was quite similar, looking at shocking animals, making them learn very complex avoidance behaviors, and then looking at their alcohol intake after. The experiment was modestly successful. It wasn't terribly successful. I looking back on the dissertation now, a lot of suggestive stuff came out of it, but nothing very definitive in terms of whether there was a relationship between stress and alcohol. Mm-hmm. There was, for the dissertation, there certainly was. We implicated certain areas of the brain, the hypothalamus and others, in some of these behaviors, but we ended up publishing several papers on the effects of stress on alcohol consumption. And the general finding was, but not very robust, but the finding was, yeah, increased stress seemed to increase the likelihood of consuming alcohol. Joe Brady came to visit our lab, and I was giving him a tour. I don't know how he knew Bob Meyer, but they did know, and I was giving him a tour, and I mentioned that, you know, I was really, really intrigued by his executive monkey, and I had two conditions where the rats actually had control and the other rats were yoked to it. So I was confirming his study. Mm-hmm. And he told me, he said, be real careful with that because we haven't been able to replicate it. And we believe what happened here is just was unique to that particular experiment. So there may not be anything so necessarily true about this executive monkey model, which was in Science. It was a big thing. It intrigued mm-hmm. me so much. And I was so discouraged that all of a sudden, one of these fundamental things by one of the pioneers in the field was incorrect. Later in my life, I realized that happens to all of us. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I remember being almost crushed that someone had gotten a paper published in Science. And apparently, it's not replicable. But I guess what distressed me more than anything else is that he didn't do anything to correct the record. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, being an older person now, more mature, I realize that, you know, probably not a lot of things you could do. I mean, what would you do? Publish another article saying the previous thing that I did was incorrect. But I'm not so sure many journals would like that, and I'm mm-hmm. not even sure how you get it published. But at the time, I thought there was just Science was very pure to me, and mm-hmm. this was just mm-hmm. the, you know, if I was wasting time, as would others, and this had a huge impact on my future research as well, mm-hmm. because my feeling about that all was, you owe it to people, and if people like graduate students and others are reading your material and then trying to go out and replicate it, or work with it, and you know it to be now incorrect for probably a whole bunch of reasons. They may have those. Now that we know ulcers are caused by bacteria, those animals could have had bacteria. They could have had a viral infection that led to results. I mean, he's a reputable guy. These things just happen to us.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm glad you told us that story. I was going to ask you what, in light of the bacteria discovery you made of the executive monkeys. So.
Yeah. I don't think there was anything to it. It sounded intrinsically logical.
Mm-hmm.
When it appeared in science, everybody said, oh, well, there's the link. I mean, executives are under stress. Mm-hmm. Workers who work for executives aren't under stress. And that was a very simple assumption. I think it's probably the opposite.
Yeah, really.
That's the case. So I got out at, when I graduated, and a fellow, Vernon Perez, had come from Washington University in St. Louis, and he'd come to our lab to learn some of the surgical techniques with primates because he was interested in a whole different range of neurobiology questions and neurochemistry. And, one of his boss, who was Blake Moore, was a protein chemist, and his interest in neuroscience became, he at, early in the, I guess the 60s or early, maybe late 50s, had come up with a concept that what we should do is look at the brain and see, since we know so nothing about the brain at all, to see whether there are proteins that are specific only to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the liver, or you look at the heart, or you look at any other differentiated organ, they have very high concentrations of particular enzymes and proteins that are really only found, lipids is for that matter too, that are only found in those organs, and in fact, it's very important to the function of that organ that that protein is there. Mm-hmm. It's an enzyme, it's whatever. So his logic was there ought to be proteins that are specific to the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could find these proteins in the nervous system, this would give us some indication this is a unique marker for the nervous system, and from that, we can then begin experiments, which is the very difficult leap, was once you find something like that, then what is its function? And what does it do in the brain? Why is it important to the brain? Why is the brain specific? So Vernon was doing some experiments with trying to go in and take out regions, subcellular regions of brain, and localize these proteins, because Blake had made a discovery of two proteins. One was called S-100,
mm-hmm.
and the other was called 14-3-2. And this was based upon their chemical properties of where they appeared in, you know, saturated ammonium and all the rest of the stuff, things I didn't really understand very well. And he had done species comparisons and had looked at it. This was evolutionary quite stable. It turns out, in historically, S100 turns out to be associated with glial cells,
mm-hmm.
and 14-3-2 was neuronal, which, when that became clear, was pretty pretty exciting as well. But you had a marker for glial function and you had a marker for neuronal function. We had no idea what these proteins did. So I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So Vernon came and gave a seminar, and we all had to entertain him. That was Bob Meyer was a very strict individual. We had a dress code, we had a behavior code. We always had to wear a lab coat, and we had to wear or have a notepad present at all times because we had to take notes whenever anything important came up. And we had to be there at 7 in the morning and couldn't leave till 10 or 11 at night. And he would actually come to make sure people were working in the lab during that period of time. Time off was a very rare event. He was a tough, tough person. Once I left Purdue, I didn't have much of association with him because he was so unpleasant and so nasty. And his wife at one point asked me on an airplane coming back from ACNP, why I didn't call him more, because he felt bad, and I was just as candid as hell. I said, well, you know, and she knew. I said, well, he's an asshole, and you know he was. And she said, well, yeah, but that was when he was young and all this sort of stuff. So, anyway.
So you finished your dissertation in 68?
68.
Okay.
And then?
And so Vernon Perez is visiting?
From Wash U.
When?
Mm-hmm. In 67. And he went through all this stuff, and I was really intrigued. And he said, well, we'll exchange the favor because we all had to entertain him too. So we had to have him over to our house and entertain him. And I got to know him pretty well. And he said, Wash U is doing some stuff like this, and you could always come and learn things. And then what it provided to me was just, by happenstance, this really seemed to be the answer to my question, because I was doing some experiments that were fundamentally mapping studies that were looking at things in a global sense, but I really didn't understand what was going on, actually physically going on. Mm-hmm. And I had no training in the areas that I really needed to get into, which was chemistry, biochemistry, mm-hmm. Doing more molecular type studies, such as they were in the 60s, and we weren't doing types of stuff being done now. So I said, I wonder if I could get a postdoctoral fellowship to go and learn as much chemistry as I possibly could. So I worked out a deal with Washington University, and the chairman of the department was a guy named Eli Robbins. Mm-hmm. And his wife is Lee Robbins, who has done the unbelievably important Vietnam study, Vietnam Veterans Return. That was Lee. So I thought this department looked like an ideal place, and I would do 1 year with Blake Moore because I was really interested in the protein aspects, and I would learn all about protein chemistry. Plus, I thought my own background in brain was maybe an aid to them because they didn't have a distinct feel for brain locations and things of this sort, and interesting questions to ask, because at that point the research was coming to a halt basically because the proteins were identified, but we didn't know what they did. And when you start asking the question, I have an unidentified molecule that's pure, mm-hmm. it's found in high concentrations in brain, so what's its function? Well, that question is so open-ended, you could do experiments for 100 years and not come to the end of it. So I thought, I can learn that and add something to the group. And then I picked a second-year project, which would involve working with Bill Sherman, who was a professor of biochemistry, and he was doing mass spectrometry, and actually at that time it was a very new procedure, and you had to, the equipment was antiquated, you had to sort of wait in line for it, and we have one technician who did the mass spectrometer, and we would then wait. But you got this fingerprint, with it, which a mass spec does for you, but you had to sit down manually and figure out what it was. Mm-hmm. So you actually had to sit there and learn the chemical structure of carbon and molecular weights and all the rest of it, and then run some standards and just sit there and interpret these audio radiogram or these pictures forever. It just was a mindless thing. So I got into the Purdue thing. I mean, after Purdue, got into this S-100 14-3-2, and part of our initial job was to go ahead and purify a big quantity, because we need a purified protein for both of them to do very important experiments like the standard curves, because we were measuring these compounds in a whole bunch of regional areas of brain, and we were doing a whole bunch of things. Plus, So the first time I did it, I had never done a chemical analysis. Vernon was helping. I was in the same lab. He was helping me, and I had to figure out how to do a molar solution and how to do all these things that I had never had any experience with. Picked it up, slowly, except the job for every new coming graduate student or postdoc was to purify a big batch of S-100, mm-hmm. because we used it pure for other purposes. We used to go to the slaughterhouse in East St. Louis and get beef brains, these huge pounds and pounds of it. So you throw it all into a blender, mm-hmm. and you start with this disgusting mix of of beef brains, and then go through extractions. And it was about a 2-week process to go through all the columns that needed to be done. Today that would be a piece of cake. People would do it instantaneously with high pressure liquid chromatography, but we had to do all the column work and all the rest of it. So I produced 56 milligrams, which is the record low for anybody who had ever been through the lab. So I don't know what happened to it. It just went away. But from that inauspicious start, we then started asking some really interesting questions about what does S-100 do in 14-3-2, and we published a lot of papers. It was a really productive period for me. And one of them was, what is the turnover of S-100? because the how rapidly does it turn over would be an interesting question with respect to is this a transient compound or is it maybe a transmitter, maybe it has something to do with very transient actions, or maybe it's a structural protein, which in which case you'd expect that to have a very long life as opposed to a shorter one. So we had to develop the techniques to do it, and also we had to get the chemical marker into the brain. So we had to actually label the S100 with a radioactive tracer, and we had to do this all ourselves. I mean, there was nothing available, and there was really no people able to do it. We had to buy the material, tritium, iodinate it, and under conditions which today we would have never done it. I mean, we played with isotopes that were so high in specific activity that you would have to have special conditions now just to go ahead and do it. But we labeled the S100. Mm-hmm. But then we had to find a way of bypassing the blood-brain barrier. So that's where my previous experience with cannulations and getting it really came to be to the forefront, because we could actually implant cannulas in the rats and inject them with this tritium morphine and then follow its degradation over time. At that time, just about several months before we were into that experiment, Bruce McEwen's group at Rockefeller University came out with a paper asserting that S100 had a less than 17-minute half-life, which would suggest it was a rapidly turning over compound, and was having something to do with a very acute function of the brain, and that was really exciting. That also was in Science. But we said, well, we'll wrap it up, because there were limitations to what he had done, and so we said, well, we'll do it in a better sort of way. Well, we went in and actually did the experiment and found that he was completely wrong. It was just an incorrect assertion. It was actually a matter of days, up to, I think, 10 or 12 days, that the S100 turned over. So it was a relatively stable compound, as such things go in brain. And we published that paper in Science.
And when would that have been?
That would have been 1969. So I did quite a bit of that, and then I had a really great opportunity to work with a fellow named Maxwell Cowan, who was then the 39-year-old head of anatomy and neurobiology at Washington University, and he subsequently he just passed away of cancer. He was the president of Howard Hughes Medical Institute. This is a prominent sort of guy, really, and he founded, first couple of years I was doing my postdoc, I became really interested in this whole neuroscience area and thought psychiatry, I was in the Department of Psychiatry, I forgot to mention that, that's Eli Robbins was head of the Department of Psychiatry, was sort of the bedrock for neurobiological efforts going on, and it made sense. We were interested in brain function, we were psychiatrists or people trained in psychiatry, and we were interested in what goes on in the brain. So we became there were no departments of neurobiology at the time. We became the center for neurobiology. And then we went around all the departments and found all those people who were interested in neuroscience in some way. And we formed the Division of Neuroscience, which I headed up for a period of time. And I'm a graduate student, or postdoc at that point. I'm the only one that had some experience in this area. So we were at a very early stage of neurobiology. I got to know Max through that system, and he said to me, one of the most intriguing questions that I would have, these are markers, it looks like S100 is glial, and 1432 is neuronal. So, and Max's biggest passion in life was tracing neuronal pathways. So there was a strong, good connection for me back to neuroscience, and again, almost back what we were doing before, but now with a whole different molecular approach. And he said, obviously, what we could do is go in and remove the eye, for example, in a chick. A chip has a very large optic tectum. And the optic tectum is where the optic nerve actually terminates in a chicken, so you can actually see it. But we didn't know where else does vision process beyond that point. We don't know. So Max was interested in that and said, if we ablate the eye and cause atrophy, which we knew it did, of the optic nerve,
where could we actually know, and there were no techniques available, where does it go from there, and how can we track the implications of it? The assumption, hypothesis was that the nerve died and everything along its pathway would have died. So his notion, and it's a brilliant notion, was again, if we marked and measured 14.32 and S100 in each area, what you would expect with neuronal damage is a drop-off in neuronal composition and a very large increase in glial, because glial is sort of the material that chops up or gloms on decaying neurons. So it's a logical thing. Okay. He said, if we actually do a careful regional analysis and go through, we can actually track pathways back into the brain in a way that no one else can. So we started working on, we worked on the chick first, and we did a several other, very productive period of publication with Max. We did those experiments, and gosh, we could track pathways and did some great stuff, which ended up with very long papers in Brain Research, which at that time was the Neurobiology Journal. It was the really big thing. So it was very successful, published probably 20 papers when I was in as a postdoc. I also worked with Bill Sherman, as I said, with the mass spec. I was doing both now. The first year I was doing it with proteins, but it carried over because I was very interested in it. But then I was working with Bill Sherman looking at the fragmentary aspects of brain. And so I did a few routine things to learn the techniques, but then actually went through and tried to identify new compounds in brain. So carrying the same logic over to say, well, these are lipids, these are chemicals that, you know, proteins at that time you couldn't do a mass spec on. This, it had to be a soluble compound, and proteins, of course, weren't, they were too big, and now that can be done, but at that time it couldn't. So we actually looked at the composition of things and found, for again, the first time, I naively was looking at this mass fragmentogram, and I went to his office and I said, you know, is it possible that there could be two equal things that look equal that are tied together in some way? Because that's what I'm coming up with. It almost looks like there's two patterns. And he looked at it and he said, that's cardiolipin, which had only been a lipid associated with heart function. And we found it in brain, which had never been seen before. And I don't know that we even know today what that amounts to, but we published that, of course. There was another thing. So now we've got emerging here is a whole unique class of compounds that are found only in the brain. So they must have some very specific function in the brain. We don't know much about what that. I think subsequently, S114 and 32 have actually been identified as something that we knew existed. We just happened to find that they were brain specific, but they're enzymes that actually work, which makes sense given their turnover and all the rest of it. So, we were very traditional. I met my wife my senior year at Villanova. We decided that we would, you know, have a long distance relationship for a while, and by no means would we get married until I completed at least my master's degree. Because at Purdue you had to get a master's first, you had to write a thesis, then you went out for a PhD. And that was 64. So I said, well, because we were talking seriously about getting married, we had to wait till I got my master's, which we did. And then she moved out to Purdue and didn't like it much because it came from the main line of the Philadelphia on the East Coast. But it was fun. Those were really fun years. We then planned we would have our first baby as soon as I had a job after Purdue, a graduate student. So I went to WashU for the postdoc, and my eldest daughter was born 3 weeks after we got there. So we cut things very tight. They did refer me to an OBGYN guy in the beginning. And a guy in Lafayette, Indiana, didn't understand, but they gave us masters in Johnson's place, which was the sexual research things, and they said, you must have the wrong place. But anyway, she was born, and I had a two-year-old. We wanted to have another boy, and I said, well, I can't be put on 2 years of postdoc was a lot in those days. So I'd had all the training I needed, and I said, well, I'm really intrigued and want to now apply all that I've learned back to my original question, which was substance abuse. I really want to go back to it. And now I'm actually interested in more than just alcohol. I'm really interested in opiates. And I read a review by Avram and Dora Goldstein, that had theories of addiction, and they had enzyme induction theories and some fascinating stuff, and I was really, really intrigued by it and thought, you know, this opiate stuff is maybe more tangible than alcohol, because alcohol is sort of a vaporized thing that infiltrates membranes and all. Maybe this opiate has more specific actions which will lend itself to some sort of study. So I said, well, I better find a job now. Now that I've got all the training, I mean, I really need a job, because I was getting $6,000 a year as a postdoc, and my wife wasn't working because we had little kids. So I said, we really need to do something. So I went to the chairman of the department, Eli Robbins, mm-hmm. and he and his wife had us over a few times. And her work fascinated me because she was working the epidemiology of drug abuse, and I thought, this is, you know, she's just a great person.
And so you would just have these conversations sort of casually?
Casual conversations, yeah. And I'd go to all of her seminars because she was really interested in substance abuse. But what was interesting about the Department of Psychiatry at that time, mm-hmm. we had Lee and we had others who were very interested in mental disorders and substance abuse. Don Goodwin was there at the time, who did the studies with genetic determinations of, in his case, alcohol, but you know, other case, drug abuse. So it was a great place. So I went to Eli and I said, I'd like to know if you would give me a reference, because I have to start looking for a job. And he said, well, why don't you just stay here? And I said, well, it never occurred to me. And he said, yeah, the reports to get back from you, you know, you're a great guy, you've got good training, and you fit in with the mission of the department, so why don't you just stay here? And so I had to go back to my wife and say, now, you know, you move from Philadelphia to Lafayette, then Lafayette to St. Louis, which is even further west, but we're going to get home at some point. We'll go back to the East Coast. So I said, well, okay. So I went back, I talked to her about it, and she was fine. So we decided we'd stay for a few years. And that was in 1969, 1970. We've been there since. So he said, well, I went back and I said, I'd really be interested in staying. So, I mean, and I had, there were so many jobs at that point that, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost, for kids getting started today, it's kind of sad, because once I got my postdoc, I was a very valuable commodity, because postdocs weren't all that frequent at the time, and given my background and all, so I was being sought after by a few places. But WashU really intrigued me a great deal. And he said, well, why don't we offer you an instructor position, and we'll start you at $13,000, which I thought, man, that, you know, from six, that's a pretty good salary. And he said, but send me your resume and your CV up and all the rest of it. So, and Eli, you have to know Eli, was a sweet man, unfortunately had MS, and that cut short his real productive years. He was still a department head. Mm-hmm. But the next morning I got a call, and he would cuss and swear all the time. He was just this really fun guy, but he was just crude. He said, Cicero, you got to get your fucking act together. And I said, what did I do? And he said, I just saw your resume, and I saw your publication list, and it's insulting for me to have offered you an instructor. You should be an assistant professor, but I'm not going to be the only one looking out for you. You got to look out after yourself. But I was so happy to be doing something that I loved to do that at times I honestly did, during that period, feel somewhat guilty, because one shouldn't make money doing something they loved. A job was a job. So he gave me an assistant professorship at $15,000. So now I was very rich and had the opportunity to move in. And I got a lab, and I got the ability to hire one technician. And I hired him. Actually, he graduated WashU on a Friday. On Saturday, he was drafted and had to go to Vietnam. So when he came back in 1971, he interviewed for the job. I gave him the job, and actually, he's still with me. It's been. I told him at the time, I said, you know, this is soft research money, and technicians normally don't last a long time. So as soon as the grant goes away, you could not have a job. But you know, things have worked out pretty well. So I took the job, and it was like in April, and I was supposed to start July 1. So I was still working in Bill Sherman's lab.
1970 or 71?
This is 70.
70.
Yeah. So it would have been July of 1970 when I started. Lee called me and said, you're interested in substance abuse a lot. I said, yeah. And she said, well, there's going to be a new group. It's going to ultimately be called maybe National Institute on Drug Abuse or whatever. But right now it's in Jerry Jaffe's office, which was part of the White House office, and they had some funding. And they said, well, they are looking for grants that they could support, and we think you'd be an ideal candidate. Why don't you go ahead and go for one? And I said, oh, that's intriguing. And she said, well, but you have to put it in the next 2 weeks. So I thought a grant had to be, I mean, just this enormous amount of work. I said, well, I can't do that. And then Eli called me and said, you're going to do it. They're looking for money, or they're looking for people to fund, and it'll be a really good opportunity for you. So I said, okay, great. So I put this application together that was looking at norepinephrine and serotonin, looking at their turnovers. And I was using a lot of techniques I had used in the past, and looking at a lot of regional localization and direct infusions and all sorts of things. It was a very, very ambitious proposal. I submitted it, and about 6 weeks later, I got a notice that I was being site visited.
Mm.
Which is a good thing. I mean, in those days, I get site visited. Except I literally crapped my pants when they told me who was coming. Lead person was Avram Goldstein.
Huh.
I mean, this was the father of stuff. I mean, this is the guy who theorized, conceptualized everything. Jerry Jaffe was the other, and Joe Cochin was the third from BU. And I said, I'm a little tiny. I'm still a postdoctoral fellow. These guys are coming, and these are the leaders of the field, sort of like you put them up as these idols, and they're coming to visit me. Why would I have this fake? And I'll never forget this. So they came. They were sweethearts. They were just pleasant. They were offering suggestions, and it was clear that Grant needed a lot of work, but they were just offering suggestions and this sort of thing. And I remember distinctly we were going to the elevator, because in those days when you did a site visit, you always did a tour of the facilities. As a site visitor later on, we all hated it, but you had to go on a tour to see where their lab was and their animal rooms and all that. So we did that, but we were waiting for an elevator, and I said, well, this elevator is really, really slow. And he goes, well, when you get your grant, you can fix it. This is Jerry Jaffe. So I assumed from that things had gone pretty well. It really, this story is kind of embarrassing for younger people getting started today, because this sort of fell into my lap. It was a circumstance of knowing Lee Robbins real well, who gave a very high recommendation, and Eli himself, but Lee in particular, sort of became a mother figure for me, and really was very helpful. So I got the grant. We began working away on it, and I just thought this was really cool, but we were largely unsuccessful. We're trying to demonstrate an effect of chronic opiate administration on norepinephrine and serotonin. We're trying to look at receptors, mm-hmm. if we could. But in those days, the opiate receptor hadn't been discovered yet. We had a lot of inferences that there must be something out there, but right. The only receptors we did know were norepinephrine and serotonin. There was just an emerging Nobel laureate-type researcher, Axelrod and others, discovering that these really were transmitters, mm-hmm. and getting the pathways they were associated with. So I was measuring the pathway of norepinephrine metabolism, and nothing very exciting was happening. It was really a dead end as far as I could tell. So we were doing a whole bunch of experiments, and my technician, I said, well, the last choice is I went through the literature and I said, there are some organs in the body that are very richly, and our problem working with the brain was there's so much of stuff in there. It's very difficult to do binding studies or to do anything, to actually look for receptors, because it gloms on to everything. There's no way to look at specificity. So I said, the ideal thing for us would be to find an organ somewhere that had nothing but norepinephrine receptors on it. And it turns out the seminal vesicles of the male rat are richly innervated by alpha adrenergic receptors, and that's about the only receptor that's functional there. And I said, now there's a great model. We can use that to tease apart the complexity of the brain. We now have an organ that only has one aspect of the brain. If we learn from the seminal vesicles, we'll use that as a model to infer what goes on in the brain itself. So we did a whole bunch of experiments. Again, we looked at acute morphine, we'd put morphine in the inductor bath, and you'd look at twitches of this, mm-hmm. this tissue, because bioassays were the big thing at that point. So we'd actually take a seminal vesicle and you'd hook it up to a strain gauge, and then hook that into a smoked drum. Actually, we smoked a drum of paper, and then you had the stylus that would measure contraction. So it was a messy, sloppy thing. But you had to build a bath, so I had to go to our glassware shop, and we had to, you know, copy what was in the literature, and it was only been a couple years old. So we used it as a bioassay, fundamentally, to assess what was going on. So we added morphine to the solution to see would this inhibit contractions or did it facilitate. And the bottom line was it showed nothing. I mean, we couldn't demonstrate a direct effect on norepinephrine, which turns out we've been pioneers in that because no one else has ever found a role for norepinephrine in opiate abuse either. But that's not what I wanted. So this is about a year and a half into the project, and I said, you know what, let's try chronic administration. And NIDA will give us these, at that time, it wasn't an institute yet, it was in the early 70s, it was, I don't even know what its official status was at that point, but they would provide pellets. That's not correct, actually. I contacted Eddie Way, I saw his paper on morphine pellets, and I said, how did you do that? And he gave me references to somebody who would do it, but then they wouldn't do it for me, so I had to find people within WashU who were medicinal chemists that helped me make my own pellets, because we just didn't have any. So we made these morphine pellets. We started implanting them in the rats, and man, they get what Eddie said was absolutely correct. They get a huge addiction response. They have a lot of withdrawal behavior. It's a great model for chronic morphine consumption. So we did some studies looking at quantitating the morphine withdrawal syndrome and things of this sort that we published in 72 or 73. And then I said, well, let's treat some rats chronically with morphine and then see what happens to the receptors. I mean, because Abram's theory at the time was with increased exposure, you will see certain adaptations occurring in the brain, and you'll see an induction was the assumption. There would be a big increase in the concentrations of proteins, enzymes, and I was theorizing perhaps the receptors. So maybe we were looking only acutely. And the real issue was this was a chronic phenomenon. So we did a couple of experiments, and I'll remember this for as long as I live. He called me one day and said, I can't find him. And I said, I'm sorry, what do you mean you can't find him? He said, I can't find the seminal vesicles in the morphine-treated animals. They're just not, they're shriveled up little things.
This is your technician was...
Yeah, he had cut them open because I was then going to take the seminal vesicle and I would bring them over and hook them up to the strain gauge and then try to look to see whether an addicted seminal vesicle would act differently than an acute one. So he said, I can't find them. I said, well, something's wrong here. And we had a big N of 10 animals, and it was uniform. I mean, they were just like a 10th percentile of, I mean, 90% reduced in weight compared to the normal. So I said, we got to repeat this and take a look at it. I said, because something's wrong. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. So we did it, and it was highly reproducible. These some of the vesicles are gone. So I abandoned any interest whatever in norepinephrine. It was just of no interest anymore, and said, now this is, I'm you know, a political science psychology major who had done some chemistry stuff as a postdoc, and I'm now beginning to ask questions of, all right, what controls physiologic function in organs like this? So where does that come from? So I had to go to the literature and learn endocrinology, because it turns out it's all hormonal. We knew a little bit at that time, but not a great deal. But it was clearly apparent that the seminal vesicles as secondary sex organs were totally dependent upon testosterone. So the most logical explanation of our results is that morphine must be depressing testosterone, or maybe it has a direct effect on the seminal vesicles. So we did a couple of experiments, and sure enough, found with a very crude assay, which was later perfected, we found that testosterone levels were reduced to almost zero in morphine-treated animals. And that was a first finding of its sort. So we published that quickly because here was an endocrine effect of morphine. That was 1973 when that got published.
Would you regard that as one of your main contributions?
Yeah, absolutely. So we then said, okay, now this is too intriguing a research question. You see, I had the freedom in those days to do whatever I wanted to do, pursue what was interesting to me. So even though the specific aims of my grant were completely the opposite, my take on it was the study section will see a logical progression that I tried to do the experiments, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and this was against the advice of some people, it seems to me that this would be a logical way to proceed. You got a negative result and you did get a positive one, follow it up, try to find out what's going on. So I pursued that and then I said, okay, what influenced testosterone? It turns out that it tracks up the pituitary gland and it's luteinizing hormone. What affects luteinizing hormone? Well, it's some factor that comes, and we didn't even know what it was at the time, it's some factor that comes from the hypothalamus. So our quest became where along this complex pathway from brain to the testes and the seminal vesicles is morphine exerting its effects. And we did some very clever experiments using techniques in endocrinology to actually pinpoint that morphine had no effect at all on the testes directly. Mm-hmm. It didn't interfere with testosterone's actions. It didn't do anything of the sort. So we tracked it back. Found out it was before the pituitary, because the pituitary went down too. Mm-hmm. But we could actually extract the pituitary and study it in vitro and show that morphine had no effect on it. We actually were able to get some of this factor and show that morphine didn't influence that. So therefore, it had to be in the brain. So morphine's effect had to be all the way back in the brain. And we pretty conclusively demonstrated that it was, in fact, brain. And there was a direct action of morphine on the brain, which led to this whole cascading of reproductive endocrinology. That's sort of the area I would be most known for at the time. But I have to back up for a minute, because when Eli offered me the job, Max Collin and I were still doing a lot of collaborative research together. And we must have put out 9 to 11 papers. And he called me, and he gives you an idea of the times. And he called me over to his office and said, I wanted you to come over. Now, he's the chairman of this department. I really like working with him. Fundamentally, though, I found a lot of what he did boring. I mean, I think tracing pathways, you know, it's you get an answer, but it just seems kind of mundane and not really interesting. He called me over and said, I understand you might be pursuing drug abuse research or something. He said, whatever they call that stuff. And I said, yeah. And he said, you're wasting your time. This is a horrible career decision. He said, you're a gifted scientist. You're doing well in here. We could do wonderful things together. And he said, but you're making a career choice that's a dead end. He goes, it isn't even a science. Mm-hmm. I mean, drug abuse is, I mean, who cares about it? It's not an important issue, number one. Mm-hmm. It is all just people who have weak character. So what the hell are you going to do biology of drug addiction for? It's just a horrible career decision. So I went back and I thought about it for a little bit and I said, you know, that's going to have to be something I'm going to confront in this medical school, because this was a cutting edge leading medical school in the country and there wasn't much in the biology of drug addiction going on. And I think most people regarded it as a second class level of research. So he cautioned me, and despite that, we still had a good relationship. He probably, till the day he died, thought I had made a career poor choice in a career, because I could have really contributed solidly to anatomy and neurobiology, mm-hmm. which by that time had become a department in his department. He said, it's a serious mistake. There's nothing to this drug abuse thing at all that you'll ever be able to pinpoint. It'll just be a waste of time. You'll be pursuing it, and you'll never get the answer.
So what kept you going in that area past advice?
I just didn't buy it. I just said, I just can't accept it. It's probably wrong. And really, it was a very almost courageous decision in a sense, because I realized I was cutting off my ties back to the basic neurobiologist who would view what I was doing in a somewhat trivial sort of way. And I got lots of feedback over the years of this being, you know, a waste of time, and I'd be invited to give seminars, but I'd almost see from people's expressions that they were so what, kind of just bored with this sort of thing. So I had to Fortunately, I had a department that was very supportive, but I basically took the stance and said, I think I'm right here, and I'm going to be given the opportunity to pursue it. Now, if I'm wrong, I can always go back. And Max and I continued to collaborate for a little bit. I did a little bit for a while until I became really busy, and it was nice, productive stuff. A good relationship, and he's a first-class scientist, no question about it. I just found what he did, and I did tell him. I said, I find what you do to be a little boring. And because he used to say to me, the only good experiment is where you already know the results. You should never do things that you don't have a well-formed hypothesis about. And so, Max, that strikes me as just being not visionary at all. I mean, I don't know the answers to a lot of the questions I'm asking, and that's the fun of asking the questions. Mm-hmm. That just seems the way it's going to be. But anyway, jumping ahead.
I've got a question from the other end, which is, what about the drug abuse research guys? I mean, what did they think of the endocrinological research that you were doing?
Oh, they were fascinated. Yeah, just fascinated that we were actually finding hormonal effect of drugs, because when you look at the action of hormones in the endocrine system on organs, hormones basically have organizational effects and they have activational effects, but the organizational effects is each hormone has a specific target and are fundamentally responsible for the health and well-being of that organ or their target tissue. From the perspective of abuse and dependence, especially intolerance, hormones almost are a biological radar signal for, not radar, flare basically, to indicate that they exactly have the function you would think that are involved in tolerance and physical dependence, because they have these long-term organizational effects. So if hormones are being changed in some way, this would lead to actual structural changes in the organs of interest or areas of brain. So that was a very intriguing new outlet that basically provided some ability to look at mechanisms of action. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of practical implications too, because no one knew that opiates, there was a little bit of speculation that opiates affected sexual function in males, but not a great deal. I mean, there was very, very scant evidence on that. So Lee Robbins was fascinated by the work, and again, Lee was just like a patron saint to me. Fundamentally, he said, there's this group called CPDD, and they're having a meeting in 1973. And we always pick a plenary speaker. And she said, I think you'd be great to come and give the plenary talk. Now, I was 31 at the time, and I thought, my goodness. And so she got me on the agenda. She got me there. And I remember going to, I don't remember what city it was. I think it was the Washington, D.C., the National Academy. We were still then part of the National Academy of Sciences. We had not spun off yet as a college. So I said, I'd be delighted to go. In the meantime, I said, well, we've done all this stuff with the rodent, and we're backing it up, and I think the implications are pretty clear. It's central nervous system, but I'm not certain. So what would be a great thing to do, because you always wonder when you do rodent studies, whether or not these have any implications for humans. So I said, the parallel in a human would be all those individuals maintain a methadone. They're on a fixed dose of methadone. It's a perfect experiment, really, if you will. So if we got males and actually asked to look at two things, their blood testosterone levels, and also, most importantly, the ejaculate volume. And people thought it was bizarre looking at this in methadone addicts, but it turns out the volume of the semen is very heavily influenced by the secondary sex organs. And if they're atrophied in any way, you're going to have much reduced volume of the ejaculate, because the sperm comes from the testes, but all the secondary sex organs offer the nutrients and all the kinds of things that make conception possible. And it turns out 95% of the volume of the ejaculate comes from the secondary sex organs, not the testes. So I said their volume of ejaculate ought to be reduced. So we got a protocol through, which I don't know if we'd ever get through now, to look at methadone addicts and also normal volunteers, which were college students and medical students that we advertised. And they all thought it was kind of cool to get paid to masturbate. So we actually got these methadone guys in and said, okay, you know, we want your blood sample, we need a history, and then, ejaculate into this. And sure enough, we found really markedly lower testosterone levels, and we found the ejaculate volume was reduced almost in direct proportion to what it was in rodents. So we published that in the New England Journal of Medicine in 76, I guess it was. The results were off that a little bit before that. And for people that were working in methadone clinics, I got a lot of resistance and a lot of people coming forward saying, the studies are wrong, they're incorrect, it's of no biological relevance whatsoever, because they were worried politically that methadone was going to be damaged by this. Because it was worse than that, I got accused, because the population is largely black, this could be construed as a government effort to suppress fertility in blacks. So this is a lot of period of racial tension around that period of time. So it was like almost government-sponsored genocide. And it got to be very political when, for me, it was a straight research question, but I hadn't been introduced to the politics of drug abuse, and I had no idea there was such loyalists. So I attend the CPDD meeting. I guess it was 76, not 73. 76. And the paper had just come out the week before. And Avram Goldstein gave the overall beginning talk, welcoming people, I think he was president at the time, welcoming people to the National Academies, and that, you know, the next few days we were going to hear a lot of exciting research. But then he proceeded to take the official position politically about my experiments and methadone maintained patients. He took the position this was a political thing, and that he said, and it makes no sense whatsoever, because if this was correct, this is before I even had a chance to speak, if this is correct, the person wouldn't be able to masturbate, according to this. Well, they did so, obviously, with great difficulty, but they could. So I said, well, that's his viewpoint. And I somehow or other flustered by it. I just said, well, so the next morning, I had the opening talk, and then went through it from the perspective of what I intended here was to basically look at this in a human to see if these endocrine studies had any message. It had an overwhelmingly positive response. Mm-hmm. And even Avram came up and apologized for having made the comments. And I said, I had no clue what a political battlefield I was getting involved in, because there were pro-methadone people, those that were definitely against it, thought it was a horrible thing. And this was going to feed into an argument that I hadn't even anticipated. And Eli Robbins and I, along with Lee, was on that paper as well. So we published that in New England Journal of Medicine. And that was my last foray, really, into humans, because I'm just interested to see whether my subsequent research had any impact on that at all. So over the next, probably 20 years, we've been looking to see how far can we get back into this nervous system to find out where is morphine exerting its effects. And more interesting to me is all the changes that, because it turns out this opened up a field of research on the effects of opiates on endocrine function as a whole. And it turns out it's massive. It affects about every hormone in the body, which probably has something to do with its physiologic effects on the body. I think it's not only probable, it's likely. We just haven't found out yet exactly what it is. There became an intense amount of competition in this area from endocrinologists who got involved. And back to the early 70s again, there was no receptor known at that point. So what you did, though, was a series of experiments looking at the optically active isomers of compounds. So you would take a morphine or a levorphanol, the L form versus the plus form versus the minus form. So you do a whole bunch of experiments to show that it was stereospecific. It implied that it was interacting with a receptor. Mm-hmm. Now, what we thought this meant was that morphine was identifying a receptor for a neurochemical already known, and that it was simply glomming onto that receptor. So, but all of us had to do experiments, and I did an experiment where we actually compared the potency of opiates versus their ability to depress testosterone, because we're actually stating that testosterone served as a biomarker for what's occurring with opiates, and there was a one-to-one correspondence. It was perfect. And you looked at the optically active isomers, only the optical active isomer did it, not the not the the mirror image, which was inactive. This was a receptor-mediated event. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there saying, there's a receptor involved in this. Now, what the hell kind of receptor it would be? And in a couple of weeks, the paper appeared in Science, and then with a quick succession of people identifying the opiate receptor, and that just opened up a whole avenue for me, because that became, well, you know what? If morphine exerts these endocrine effects, there must be ligands in the brain that also interact with the opiate receptor. So that's the whole endogenous opioid thing. We actually then began to focus on endogenous opioid mediated control of the hypothalamus. And it turns out there's a whole network of opioid systems that impinge on the pituitary in ways in which we're still not totally clear. It affects prolactin, the growth hormone, oxytocin, every hormone in the brain, but we still have not been able to link it up to something to do with tolerance or dependence and exactly what it's doing. But thinking back on it, those early studies by accident, mm-hmm. looking at the seminal vesicles, started this whole thing that evolved into fundamentally my career, mm-hmm. of just tracking these things down. And it was nice. It was a very collegial sort of thing, because interestingly, it gave me a little bit of respect among the neurobiology community as a whole, and particularly in my university, mm-hmm. because this did in fact come back to be significant biology, mm-hmm. and the opioids were actually there. So I got a lot of calls after about 15 years of being this outcast. Got a lot of calls from people saying, you know, this is really interesting stuff, and they wanted to get back at it from a different perspective. So I had a lot of collaborations. But that first 5 or 10 years was a lonely sort of thing. I kind of felt badly that my neurobiologist friends, that I had been, you know, such an active part of it, now I had just sort of written it off as some frivolous use of time, and mm-hmm. it was non-productive. I think a lot of drug abuse researchers in that period faced it in extremely competitive medical schools where biology and neurobiology was now mushrooming. It was becoming this huge whole change in direction the way we looked at things. Psychology courses now and in the 70s and 80s are so biologically oriented that it's all really, they're basically neurobiology department.
So go back and finish your sentence. Drug abuse researchers faced
huge obstacles in doing research. You had to be so convinced yourself that the research was important, that you had to pursue it, even when other people were telling you it wasn't a worthy pursuit. And most of us that were getting grants reviewed, for example, if it didn't go to a study section where there was drug abuse experts, got clobbered, because the overall scientific community still did not view it at that point. They do now, but they did not view it at that point as real science. It was trying to explain something. Again, I'm repeating myself, but it's trying to explain something that is inherently something is wrong with these people. And they have a brain disorder, and they have weak, that I heard that so many times. They have weak egos. There are all kinds of psychological theories about it all. But it was a personality defect, and we're never going to understand the biology of personality. Turns out now in psychiatry that may not be a true statement. We actually may be able to do something along those lines. So that was my career for a long time, until about 10 years ago. And I was appointed again by Lee Robbins, gave my name to somebody in the Food and Drug Administration, because there was a drug abuse advisory panel. And she gave my name as a potential member of this advisory council. And that was in 82, and I never heard a word, and I just thought, I even forgot that I had been appointed to it. But I got a call in 1985, actually it was, I forgot his name, I'll think of it in a minute, but called me and said, Harder was his last name, and said, we have this drug abuse advisory committee. It hasn't met in 3 years because the previous director got angry at the advice he was given, so he just disbanded the committee. But the committee is functioning, and we're going to start meeting again. Our problem is we don't have a chairman. Would you be willing to be the chairman? And again, this was Lee Robbins' suggestion that I would be a great chairman for it. So I said, honestly, I'm honored, but I don't know that I can do it because I've never been to an FDA meeting. I don't know what you guys do. I don't know the considerations and all that. So surely there has to be someone experienced. And they said, well, we really don't have anyone. You know, we'll walk you through the process and whatever. So we had our first meeting, and I looked at I think desazine was the first pentazazine derivative, and I chaired this group made up of all the illustrious people in the drug abuse field, Bill Martin, and others that are, you know, still good friends to this day. And we took on these issues, and I got to understand the FDA process really well, what they're after, and I got to understand the industry process. And what struck me was the gulf between the two. They were at such a confrontational situation. It was the whatever the industry said is the FDA almost had to take the opposite point of view. And what I tried to do was be a peacemaker here and bring them together and say the data ultimately have to be what guides us and what goes through. And we need to generate data. And it would struck me that being through these meetings, a lot of the evidence being presented was the same, but there was interpretation by the company, which of course was very favorable to the company position, very biased. Then there was the FDA position, which was biased in exactly the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So the Drug Abuse Advisory Committee was in the middle trying to weigh two very divergent points of view and realizing that people had agendas here that went beyond the science. It was the company trying to hide stuff from the committee because they want us to see the data. And the FDA basically was reacting, this is an evil company who will do anything for money. So we have to be very careful about what they do. So it's a very, very unhealthy relationship. I can't say I made a huge impact. It still exists, I think, in my estimation. But I got to know the process really well. And what was very clear to me was, especially with product recalls and all the rest of it, is there really is no fundamental way in which the FDA, once they've approved a drug, really monitors its safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no conceivable way that could be done. So I got out, and Ortho McNeil, Johnson & Johnson, called me and said, we had this new drug called Tramadol that's going to be coming out. It's going to be called Ultram in this country. We would like... Go ahead.
Can I interrupt just back to 1985 real quick?
Yeah.
What kind of data were you getting in terms of, as a committee having to assess...
All company-generated reports. Mm-hmm. That the FDA had required.
Okay.
We also would do our literature, our homework with the literature with like compounds, but mm-hmm. fundamentally what was presented with the IND, mm-hmm. they presented all the mandated experiments that the FDA said you must do.
Okay.
They had to do sometimes literature reviews. So we would get, the week before the meeting, four or five boxes of all these records and these files and had to try to digest as best we could. And then they would make a presentation. It was a tough job.
And did you do any post-marketing stuff at that point where you were reassessing? It was all
so this
just
is really
new.
The beginning of post-marketing yeah. surveillance. Is
yeah.
the story you're telling us.
Exactly, yeah. There was nothing going on. It was just like everything dropped off the edge. The drug was approved, the company got it, and then nothing happened until there was a huge public health crisis. Mm-hmm. There was this huge problem. The drug was now killing people, and the FDA had not been able to detect what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So the FDA was beginning to play around with the idea of maybe mandating that there be some sort of follow-up with it, but not quite yet. So in 93,
mm-hmm.
Ortho McNeil calls me and said, would you take a look, come consult with us? And I, they waited. My term with the FDA ended July 1st. So they said, you have to understand now, ethically, I can't talk about anything that's occurred the previous 8 years. That's the other thing. I was supposed to only chair it for 3 years, but for whatever reason, they asked me to stay on for 8 years. So, a lot of fascinating stuff during that. We approved Actique, I remember, the oral lozenge, lollipop,
mm-hmm.
Fentanyl mm-hmm. Preparation. I remember the enormous pressure on that from the media, and the committee was very worried about kids picking up these fentanyl lollipops. It was a great concept, had a place, and we eventually did approve it, but it was one of the most difficult negotiating times on the committee. But anyway, getting back to this Johnson & Johnson thing, so looked at it and they said, you know what, is there a possibility we could get an unscheduled status for this? And I said, well, it's an opiate, number one, although it does have a mixed profile, but its abuse seems to be very low based upon the primate studies that were done, the rodent studies, and that may be because of its other mechanisms of action. So I said, you know, let's try to bridge this gap between companies and the FDA. So why don't we go ahead and schedule, now this is the Friday before the FDA was being held on Tuesday, why don't we schedule a one-on-one meeting with the FDA and suggest or talk with them about the possibility of it being unscheduled and that you would then commit to do certain things to look at its safety profile, because it's my belief that we're not looking at these things. So Curtis Wright at the time was, I guess, director of the division. I'm not quite sure what the division was within the FDA. But we sat down, first time I ever met him, we sat down at this meeting, and I went through my little spiel, and I told the company, if I'm going to consult for you, you're going to keep quiet, and you're going to let me speak for you with the FDA, because I did know Kurt from my FDA days. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I said I hadn't met him before. And I said, I have a relationship with him that we can talk. So we had a candid discussion. I said, Kurt, you know, I've served in this committee for a long time. He was fairly new to the process, but you saw the committee. What occurs to me is we don't have a lot of quality data. We're trying to predict the future with very uncertain data, and that has a very iffy sort of component to it. And we've always said we're not going to know what happens to a drug when it's been out 5 or 10 years. So I said, doesn't it make some sense to say let's have a real rigorous post-marketing surveillance program that will be put into place? We called it, I don't even know what we called it at the time. And in exchange for doing that, have it unscheduled pending the results of a independent steering committee. The steering committee will be made up of experts, and we got J&J, who needs a lot of credit in this whole thing. We got them to agree to appoint an independent committee. Now, how is it going to be independent? We said we would issue joint reports to the company and the FDA simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So the company would not see our reports. And we would do this on a quarterly basis to carefully monitor abuse as best we could across the country. And in so doing, my argument to Kurt was, if we did this, then really you could safely take a non-scheduled status on a drug pending the outcome of the study, because we had enough credibility to them and the other people that were going to serve on the committee that we could basically assure the government that if anything really did go wrong here, we would be the first ones to blow the whistle. And J&J, I remember there was corporate discussions I had to discuss with their lawyers. Mm-hmm. They were very nervous about this. There are two objections. Why do we want to find cases of abuse that we don't even know about? Why do we want that? Liability perspective. And secondly, is this really ultimately going to protect us? I mean, and the fact that this committee can do something without our approval is like turning over our fate to this company. Mm-hmm. To their credit, we sold them that it was a good idea. That getting data, and judging by my experience in the FDA, getting objective data is what was most lacking in the FDA approval process. So this would be some real hard data, and of course you got to live with it. I was candid with them and said, you know, we may end up finding a lot of abuse, in which case we're going to be obligated to report to the FDA, and you'll be scheduled in a second, mm-hmm. which had an enormous marketing impact.
Sure.
Kurt thought about it for a minute and said, this is an experiment we could try, isn't it? And I said, I think it is. I think it's an experimental approach. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I'll commit on behalf of the company that I was sitting in the back of the room, and they let me go on. And I said, I'll commit that the company will do the following things. Some of them we had discussed, some of them we didn't discuss, but I just said we'd go ahead and do the following thing. So, mind you, the meeting was scheduled on Tuesday, and the FDA had already written its 5 or 6 issues it wants the committee to look at, mm-hmm. all of which were involved in the scheduling, of course, which schedule should it be in. And now we're taking a completely different mm-hmm. point of view. Kurt agreed, I agreed, and we said we'd alter the whole presentation for that day, to go to the fact we're acknowledging a low abuse potential, but we're saying it's low enough that we can actually market it as an unscheduled drug pending the outcome of these studies. Well, the committee basically loved the idea and thought this was a great drug to try a new experiment on, because our concern was the approval process really didn't protect public health at all. Mm-hmm. Because we approved drugs, we saw there was a need for opiate medications, but then we approved them and no one ever tracked it. Mm-hmm. And so they become huge abuse problems. So, you know, what was the original approval process about? I mean, the public health apparently stopped that approval of a drug, but didn't extend to what was happening afterwards. So that was, we really became active, got a big budget from the drug companies, and I got elected chairman of the Independent Steering Committee, which we still meet. It's been 12 years. It's going to be absorbed by Denver Health now, which is a nonprofit corporation, which is a good positive development. But we published the first in the series in a post-marketing surveillance studies that were looking at the abuse of tramadol. From that, we got some interest from other companies to see whether, in fact, they could join in these efforts and sort of doing the post-marketing. It became pretty successful, such that the FDA then, after they saw it, we had two additional Drug Abuse Advisory Committee meetings to check to see whether the data justified this position. We had a WHO meeting to see about worldwide, two of those, worldwide scheduling. And to my great pleasure, the data won the day every time. The data indicated that this had very low abuse potential, and the drug still remains down the schedule as a result of that. But it sort of set the benchmark then for additional post-marketing surveillance programs. And in about 2001, the FDA came out with a mandate that every new drug has a risk management post-marketing surveillance program. The reason being, they thought they had this obligation to protect the public once they approved a drug and released it, that the public should be protected by having some sort of post-marketing surveillance program. We got involved with Purdue Pharma through Sid Schnall, who had been a member of the Independent Steering Committee for a while. He moved over to Purdue, and they had OxyContin, the nightmare of OxyContin. So now we had a drug, tramadol, that was not scheduled versus a drug that's way at the other end of the, mm-hmm. the spectrum with a horrible abuse potential. And they wanted to launch a very extensive post-marketing surveillance program as well, which I'm involved with. So your light's flashing.
Yeah, fortunately we have.
Yeah, and we have another interview at 1.
I know.
So
I'm rapping.
But the OxyContin story is certainly one we want to hear.
Yeah. So,
okay.
The OxyContin.
This is still going. This is fine.
Yeah, we're fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, the OxyContin story. Purdue Pharma thought that if they gathered data, what would be shown quite clearly is that this has all been a media hype, a government hype. It is not a true epidemic. Mm-hmm. They were not happy with the results that we started producing, which indicated that it was just as bad, every bit as bad as the media was portraying it, maybe worse. Mm-hmm. This did not please the company executives very much, but we had built into our contracts that we owned all the data, the universities owned the data, and we would publish those data as we felt free. So that was a little awkward for them, because they had this problem now with a committee that basically didn't necessarily toe the line with what they wanted, and was going ahead and let us publish stuff. So fundamentally, what we've concluded is that OxyContin was as bad a drug as it was being made out to be, and that the company had really erred in the way they marketed the drug, because they were advertising that it was impervious to abuse because people couldn't defeat the system. Well, addicts are extraordinary clever people, and they discovered the mechanism of breaking this thing up very, very, very quickly. So it was a no-brainer for them. And eventually OxyContin went generic, and we were sort of able to track that as well. But the real purpose in looking at us was, A, they thought that we would absolve them of any blame in this OxyContin, that it truly was a media event. Mm-hmm. Not true. They didn't get that wish at all. Their other was that they have a post-marketing surveillance program in place for a new drug coming out, Paladone. Mm-hmm. Which was a hydromorphone sustained release preparation. We looked at the data after it was already approved to go on the market, and it was so clear a little bit of alcohol ingested with that compound would completely dissolve its contents. Mm-hmm. So having a drink within a certain period of time would dissolve its contents. Told the company, this is a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, it's just awful. Well, the drug was pulled in about 2 months from the market by the company, which kind of went under a little bit. And that was probably the stroke of good fortune for us, certainly not for the company. But Denver Health came along, which is a nonprofit health authority in Denver associated with the poison control centers. And they offered to buy the Radars name from Radars, mm-hmm. which is what that's what it was called, that's research,
right.
Or whatever the acronym stands for. So now the Purdue Pharma, though, is still paying subscription fees to Denver Health, but now all of our agreements are with Denver Health, a nonprofit. So all of my research agreements are through a nonprofit organization over which the companies have no influence. Mm-hmm. And this is becoming a model now. Johnson & Johnson, I was still working with Johnson & Johnson until June 30th. Well, will be until June 30th. But they've agreed to sign on to the Denver Health System as well. So our association with the company will end, all of which is a very positive development because now we understand we have another company that will be joining us. We have a meeting this week. Will be joining us as well, subscribing to it. So we're getting a lot more drugs. It's really caught on that we can, in a very objective way, without any interference. Because despite the fact that both companies were wonderfully supportive, J&J in particular, I don't say Purdue was necessarily, there was always a tension because we were producing data which potentially impacted their market. Mm-hmm. And that's a natural tension that's going to be there forever. My own view is, and I'm pushing now for something that just appeared in the journal about a month ago, of an independent post-marketing surveillance program that's funded in some fashion, maybe by fees to companies. Every company has to pay a certain fee. They'll get into it, but it has to be independent because if we allow companies to do it and interpret the data, they're going to be looking at their own self-interest, not the public health.
Mm-hmm. Where is that article coming out?
It was in New England Journal of Medicine.
Okay.
Two authors, Ray and I've forgotten the two authors' names, but it's a great idea. And I called them and want to work with them to establish. We could truly establish an independent post-marketing surveillance program. The FDA doesn't have the money. NIH doesn't have the money. Nor do I think they should be spending it. This is a product, and it's product safety. That really is not NIH's perspective or NIDA's perspective, and they cost horrific amounts of money. A company ought to have the public responsibility that is responsible for the drug it's marketing. Mm-hmm. And it can't directly control because we've seen that. With, you know, the Vioxx story is quite, I heard rumors 3 years ago of cardiac effects, and don't tell me the company didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. What they did see was a $2.6 billion a year drug. That's a very powerful incentive. And in some ways you can understand why they would be reluctant to decrease the sales of that drug. So they're willing to go on, even though they know in the background there's some adverse event. It's a horrible thing that we've allowed happen, but solving it at a government level is probably not the way to go. But this independent center I'm really, really in favor. So I'm still doing some of my endocrine research. Mm-hmm. But it's become, I've been Vice Chancellor for Research for the last 10 years. It's become sort of a secondary interest, and the bigger interest, especially in the waning parts of my career, although it's got a long way to go yet, is the public health concern. I think this is really important. Mm-hmm. And drugs used for pain, analgesics, are vastly underutilized in this country because of fears of addiction, which may or may not be rational. We don't know enough about that yet to say, but we really have got to move into the arena of making people understand these are useful drugs for pain and they ought to be used more, not less. Mm-hmm. But we have to be wary of abuse and we have to have systems in place that will monitor that abuse. And the biggest challenge, I think, now is the other aspect of a risk management program, which, of course, is once you've identified the risk, what do you do with it? And you go into a certain area of the country and you find a big problem, which tends to be local. How do we solve that? How do we go in and educate people and reduce the risk? Because these are all risk management programs, risk minimization programs. And I have become just extraordinarily passionate about this because I think it's really, really, truly important. And my mantra has always been, data have got to drive all of our decisions. And we've got to have data in the most timely way possible to make decisions that are in the overall best interest of the public. Mm-hmm. And I think the FDA is now adopting that in a variety of different ways. They respect greatly what we do. They've never liked the company having to fund it, and I don't particularly like it either, because they still have this distrust of companies. But now that we're moving into a nonprofit status, and when we were independent steering committee for Tramadol, we had a wonderful working relationship because they knew I would give them the real skinny. If I thought there was a problem, I'd let them know. We'd have meetings very often, which would make the drug company nervous as hell. We'd have meetings that were on the record, but there'd be a very small group of people in the room. We'd talk about the data, and they'd say, well, don't you think it's kind of high there? I'd say, I don't really think so. And we'd talk it through. There was a real collaborative atmosphere to it, to work with the FDA, and that really has to be fostered, because the way that the drug companies are structured in this country, they're the ones that put the drugs out there, making all of the money. They're going to have to be held accountable for the safety of their drugs. They've got to put some money into these efforts, but they can't be in control, because we have enough evidence, unfortunately, that if they know the adverse events, they point it out to them, they tend to ignore them. So there needs to be an independent watchdog who will sort of look at it. On the other hand, you can't be the FDA either, or the DEA, where there's a mindset of policemen there, and the mindset usually is, let's control everything.
Right, so the risk is overscheduling something and then taking it out of the hands of
patients. Taking it out of the hands of patients, yeah.
That's terrific.
Well, that's
fun.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you.
It's fun.
Appreciate it.
I hope I didn't keep you late.
Oh, no,
it's going to be all right.